How did you become interested in this particular field of study?
The answer to that begins a long time ago. I guess as a young person, I was very affected by the social and political movements of the 1960s and 1970s, and so that shaped my early political formation, and then it shaped my course of study beginning in high school and then certainly in college. I was particularly attracted to African-American political thought because in studying it, I discovered a tradition, an intellectual and political tradition, where there was deep engagement with questions of democracy, justice, equality, and where there were sort of insights on American inequality that you didn't find in other intellectual traditions. There was a kind of truth-telling that I wasn't finding elsewhere. So I think that was the kernel, that was the beginning of my attraction to the field.
All right. What about that movement really lit a fire in you?
Well, you know, I'm a scholar of Black radicalism, and my first book was on the civil rights movement in New York City in the 1940s and 1950s. And my last book, The Black Revolution on Campus, looks at this dramatic story of African-American students who engaged in direct action protests at colleges and universities around the country and really transformed higher education. They created affirmative action, ethnic studies, African-American studies. They fought for open admissions in many public universities. They fought for access for working-class students, students of color, to higher education, to affordable higher education, and then they sought to transform the curricula of American higher education. So when I first discovered this in the archive, I was really incredibly impressed by the fruits of this struggle, and it really struck me that it had been really downplayed in the narrative of the civil rights and Black power movements. Generally, a lot of in public history and in a lot of academic textbooks, the civil rights movement is portrayed as sort of peaking with passage of congressional legislation in the mid-1960s, and then often the portrayal of the Black power movement is one of kind of violence and critique, but no real accomplishment. It's portrayed very negatively in many scholarly and popular accounts. And so what I discovered in researching this book, The Black Revolution on Campus, is that actually there were many achievements during the Black power phase of the long Black freedom movement. So the focus of in my book, I would say the main chronological focus for the student activism is 1968 to 1972. That was really the high watermark of student organizing, and they were really successful, actually, in changing policies and practices at universities across the country. And that sparked in part another kind of intellectual movement, the Black Studies movement, that the book looks at as well. So I guess I became impassioned when I came to see how neglected this story was, yet how incredibly consequential the story was.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that the story was neglected and that you came across it in the archives, because I grew up around that time. And I don't really remember hearing or seeing or reading a lot about this at that time.
Were you reading the newspaper?
Well, I was very young at that time.
Probably why. It was certainly all over the press. The press certainly covered this phenomenon. I mean, just like the press covered... maybe I should take that back. It was all over the African-American press, and it was in the white press a little bit. I mean, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, you know, the Washington Post gave much more attention to white student activism at places like Columbia, Berkeley, Ann Arbor. They gave some attention to Black student activism, but not as much. But it is in the newspapers. You certainly can find it in the newspapers. The San Francisco State strike, which is kind of ground zero for the story, was, you know, widely covered on the evening television news in the Bay Area. So if you were living during this period and sort of casually reading the newspaper or casually watching TV news in some of these cities, you would have had a glimpse that this was happening. But it kind of, I think, fell out of popular memory pretty quickly, and then it really wasn't taken up by scholars until relatively recently.
Was the black student movement inspired by the white student movement, or was it inspired by the larger civil rights movement, or what exactly sparked this movement?
Well, I would say that the white student movement was really inspired by the black student movement. One thing that the book argues is that that the white New Left has gotten much more attention, but actually this movement was bigger and more consequential. The first major building occupation, most people think it happened at Columbia University in April 1968. It really happened at Howard University in March 1968. This was a struggle that was also happening at historically black colleges, was happening at historically black colleges across the South. So it just grew. What influenced the students was the civil rights movement. They completely saw this as the next phase, the next stage of the civil rights struggle. A lot of them were seasoned movement veterans. Many had gone South on the Freedom Rides. Some had been members of SNCC. Many SNCC leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, saw the next stage of SNCC after organizing in the South as organizing black college students nationwide. So the new organization that grew out of activism in these years was called the Black Student Union. It had different name on different campuses, but basically African-American college students organized new organizations on American campuses, and they were the main political vehicle for this story. But it really is part of, I think it's really appropriate to see the black student movement as a critically important chapter in the long black freedom struggle.
As part of this movement, were many whites involved with trying to help the black students achieve their goals, or was this largely black students leading this movement?
The latter, yes. This was black students leading this movement, but on many campuses they were waging this fight on majority white campuses in many instances. So it was often very useful and important to get the solidarity and support of white students, particularly, for example, at San Francisco State, where the Black Student Union waged a 4-month strike with the creation of an autonomous Black Studies Department as the first demand. So they ended up trying to kind of shut the campus down. And if you're, a minority student population on campus, you're going to need to organize and build coalitions and build relationships. And they were really successful and forging relationships with Mexican-American students, with Asian-American students, and with European-American students on that campus. And on other campuses, white students, through their own organizations, like Students for a Democratic Society, of course, I shouldn't term that a white organization. It was mixed, but it was predominantly white. They often would wage solidarity protests or marches when black students were engaged in their own activism on the campus. So this was a black-led movement, and and typically in a lot of the protests, the building occupations, and the like, it was these were conducted by black students, sometimes in alliance with Latino students, but more typically that solidarity and support would be manifest in support protests apart from what the black students were doing.
Who were some of the leaders of the black student movement of the late 60s and early 70s? Are there any names we would recognize today?
Well, they were very inspired by Stokely Carmichael, who changed his name around this time to Kwame Ture, and then shortly moved out of the United States to the African nation of Guinea. But Stokely Carmichael was he wrote a book, co-authored a book called Black Power that came out in 1967, and that was very influential on the students. The autobiography of the late Malcolm X was also very influential on the students. Many of the students were admirers of the Black Panther Party. In cities like New York, San Francisco, and Chicago, many of the students were actually members of the Black Panther Party. So the Black Panthers were important icons and sources of influence. But this was a very decentralized movement. It was led by autonomous campus groups, all over the country. So a lot of the names of the student activists, I don't think, will be well known to your listeners, will be famous. I mean, the names of some of the scholar activists who were associated with the movement will be better known, people like the historian Lerone Bennett or the poet Sonia Sanchez, the kind of scholar activists in the Black Studies movement were better known. But the students, for the most part, were not famous people. They were ordinary college students who really committed themselves to being, you know, effective and skilled activists. And they did, you know, they won many, many reforms across the country.
Yeah. How do Black students today benefit from that movement?
Well, sadly, affirmative action has been under legal attack now for many years, creating new admissions policies that had inclusion and diversity, particularly racial and ethnic diversity, as its real goals. Like, that was a major achievement of the students in the 1970s. In some cases, getting it at the City University of New York, they actually won an open admissions policy, saying that a public university should commit to admitting, you know, any graduate of a public high school who wants to go to college. So they really had this idea that higher education is a right, and there should be a generous financial aid. The tuition should be affordable. There should be a kind of inclusive admissions process so that college education is not just for the elite, but is really for a broader segment of the American population. So they had a major impact on rethinking who should go to college, what should the process of admission be like, how much should college cost. They really wanted to democratize higher education in that sense. Another important legacy we take this for granted. I think, you know, this whole idea of multiculturalism, I mean, that's really a byproduct of this whole campus struggle. Getting much more inclusive and diverse cultural programming on campus. Many campuses now have Black cultural centers. They have multicultural, learning environments or centers or initiatives. And all of these kinds of institutional developments grew out of the student activism of the 1960s and 1970s. And then, of course, very, very importantly, were the intellectual legacies of this movement, the creation of African American studies, and then later the creation of Latino studies, Asian American studies, gender and women's studies. These kinds of new interdisciplinary units that broaden knowledge about African American, Latino, Native American history in the U.S. and around the world. These were sort of very, very important legacies that are still with us and are still going very strong. And many universities, they're thriving, they've grown. And other universities, unfortunately, due to austerity and budget cuts, they're suffering more. But they've been an important and lasting, enduring result of the student activism.
So it sounds like you feel people of all backgrounds really benefited from this Black revolution on campus from the late 60s and early 70s.
Absolutely, yes.
What did anything surprise you while you were researching this book, The Black Revolution on Campus? Anything you came across that kind of surprised you?
I think I was surprised to discover how much the FBI had infiltrated Black student organizations around the country. They considered, this was, of course, the high point of the counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO. That was a secret, actually illegal program that J. Edgar Hoover had been clandestinely running for several years, and he targeted all manner of Black leaders. And by this point, he saw Black students as a real threat to the nation, and he ordered every FBI agent to develop what he called ghetto informants. Somebody he wanted them to have to cultivate a Black informers on college campuses. And he tried to develop information. You know, he was so afraid of Black student organizations plotting, who knows what was in his imagination. But he, of course, he never found evidence of any of these fantasies that he had. But he really tried to disrupt and infiltrate the Black student movement itself. And then another unfortunate discovery was how much law enforcement, how many presidents, either by their own choice or under pressure from legislators, would call in the police or the State Guard or National Guard to campuses to put down student protests. And then I discovered more killings, actually, of college students than I had been aware of. I mean, I had been aware of the Jackson State, the Orangeburg massacre in 1968 at Orangeburg, South Carolina State College at Orangeburg, but I discovered police killings of students at Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and at North Carolina A&T in Greensboro. So more lethal violence being used against Black student protesters was a very alarming discovery of the research. And then the kind of FBI obsession with Black student activism and his efforts to infiltrate Black student organizations.
Do you feel another Black revolution is needed on campus today?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I feel like our whole society is, as Dr. King would say, we need a revolution in values. And I completely agree with that. The president, in his State of the Union address, tried to really stress the growing problem of inequality in the United States. And I think the whole country would benefit by a revolution that brought us more jobs, more affordable higher education, the end of the school-to-prison pipeline. And we have, you know, more people in, you know, more African-American men in jail than in college in some states. And that's just an abomination. That's an embarrassment for all of us. And, you know, we've learned that the police and the court system will arrest African-Americans for marijuana use, for example, at rates so disproportionate to their use of the drug compared to whites. You know, there's a real racial disproportion in terms of who gets arrested, who gets prosecuted, who gets sentenced to jail. So I feel like incarceration is a major crisis in this country, unemployment is a major crisis in this country, and just this incredible income and wealth inequality that's been growing dramatically. So if we could like begin to more directly tackle these issues, these major kind of major problems in our society, I think that we would really improve society, certainly for Black people, but for all Americans.
What lessons might be learned from that movement that could be applied towards tackling some of these challenges today?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think that we need to, you know, today we also face newer problems. I mean, we have this extraordinary role of money in politics that has, I think, really threatened democracy. And the Supreme Court has unfortunately upheld it. And I think that many people feel that it's very difficult for them to, you know, it's very difficult for Congress, for the executive branch, for the legislative branch to work together and pass the kinds of public policy that will advance social welfare in the United States. I mean, we just look at this, you know, the crazy fight that was put up against the president's health care bill, and that was already so watered down and so many compromises and concessions have already been made. So we've learned that it's very, I think, partly because of the role of money in politics, but we've learned that it's very difficult to get just basic, helpful legislation through Congress. So I think, you know, one lesson from the 60s is that maybe these are times when social movements and other kinds of activism and protest might be required again to find ways to put other kinds of pressure on politicians, on institutions to make change.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm writing a book on sort of broadly, it's on neoliberalism, violence, and Black life, really focusing on the whole debate around gun control, the Second Amendment, and its relation to Black politics.
And are you focusing on Chicago for that particular book?
Will be a big case study. I'll look at some congressional debates. There'll be a national view as well, but Chicago will definitely be, you know, a big part of it.
Is that simply because Chicago's nearby, or are there other reasons for choosing that city as
I think both. I mean, I could easily be, you know, living in LA or Detroit or New York and also, you know, choose, you know, a major city where these questions of gun violence and crime and high mortality rates of young Black and brown men have been major social problems and social questions. So, you know, Chicago is you know, one of a couple, I think, that would be good case studies. But because it's where I live, it does make it easier.